This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
The first hour of the Cincinnati Enquirer on Mondays is brought to you through generous underwriting from the Northeastern Lions Club.
Hello, my name is Ed Goldman. This is the first hour of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Monday, May 20th, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. In this hour, I will read today's business news, editorials, including letters to the editor, and local, state, national, and world news. It so happens today we do not have a business section or editorials, so we will start by turning to the front page news. The first article is entitled, Commission Passes Zoning Code Change. There's a large color photograph showing the inside of City Hall, where the Cincinnati Planning Commission is meeting. To the left, there are rows and rows of people sitting in the chairs. To the right, there is a row of the commissioners, the public Cincinnati Planning Commission, sitting on the right. The subtitle is Connected Communities Moves Forward After 5-Hour Debate, written by Sharon Coolidge and Sidney Franklin. After 5 hours of public comment, Cincinnati's City Planning Commission voted 6-0 Friday to pass Connected Communities, a proposal billed as a historic rewrite of the city's zoning code that would allow for more density. Vice Mayor Jean-Michel Lemon Kearney, who also sits on the 7-member Planning Commission, abstained from the vote. She questioned how the plan would help create more affordable housing, with Mayor Aftab Pirival firing back that the plan would lower rents because the new code would allow for more row homes citywide for first-time homebuyers. If we don't make a change, we will only be a city for wealthy people, Pirival said. That wasn't enough for Kearney. I know you all think I'm totally against it, and I'm not, she said. My feeling is Connected Communities. It's a really good start, but there might be input from the community that could make it even better. If we work together with our citizens, we could come up with something that actually works, end quote. Dozens spend Friday afternoon at hearing, is the title of the next section. Affordable housing continued to be a point of contention among the public today. At least 170 people signed up to speak at Friday's Planning Commission meeting. Chairman Brian Stallworth called the day a, quote, wild ride. In the end, 84 people held the microphone in person at City Hall or on Zoom. The speakers ended their commentary around 3:23 p.m., with 48 people speaking out against the plan and 36 for it. Toward the end of the comment period, Mount Auburn resident Rico Blackman, 26, voiced opposition and noted there were very few black people among the speakers Friday. The city says it was intentional in gathering the opinions of black residents because Cincinnati's zoning code has historically led to segregation and displacement, Pirival said. Many of our in-person events were in historically black neighborhoods and disinvested communities, he added. We do believe all voices matter. Much of the opposition focused on what the speaker said was lack of engagement, something Pirival has contested. The city's planning department and elected officials spent 2 years on public engagement, hosting 34 events or meetings, as well as personal outreach to community councils from the mayor's office, they say. The next section is titled Opponents, More Engagement Needed. That desire for more community engagement is something the most vocal residents have been loud about for weeks. Ever since the draft legislation was released on April 11th, there's been growing backlash from average residents toward the plan. People worry about how the proposal will affect parking in congested business districts, the city's aging infrastructure, and how the city will keep predatory landlords from taking advantage of renters. More than anything, people said they didn't feel they were being heard by the city. At least 9 community councils, which regularly deal with neighborhood zoning issues, formally opposed it. Many remain unsure and want more information, according to the Inquirer's research. At Friday's Planning Commission meeting, loud applause could be heard after many of the opposing comments. As Speaker and East Hyde Park resident Michael Hauser noted, quote, "You have succeeded in connecting communities. I don't believe we've ever been so connected." The title of the next section is What's Next for Connected Communities. The Planning Commission's recommendation to pass Connected Communities means the legislation will be reviewed by City Council's Budget and Finance Committee on June 3rd. It will ultimately need approval from the full 9-member council. Our next article is Cincinnati Star Superintendent Exits Amid Union Budget Problems by Madeline Mitchell. 2 weeks before she decided to resign from Cincinnati Public Schools, Superintendent Irineta Wright said all was well with the district's unions. Their interactions were friendly and communications honest, she said, or so she thought. Then 2 days before she submitted her resignation letter, all 6 unions announced votes of no confidence in her leadership. She was shocked. Still, Wright remained steadfast in her devotion to the district. But 2 hours before she stepped down on Wednesday, Wright had grown a bit weary. She met with the Inquirer's editorial board and laid out the obvious. Cincinnati's unions wanted her out. And another truth, she didn't want to stay in a place that didn't want her around. By the time the school board announced her intent to resign, Wright, the superintendent who union leaders say had always craved the spotlight, was nowhere to be found. Her chair sat empty on the Board of Education stage, her nameplate still in place. Wright, who was hired to be the face of a district supposedly ready for change, was told to stay away. Quote, "She's a star," School Board President Eve Bolton said after Wednesday's meeting. "She is gifted and she is dedicated to kids and dedicated to public education, and my hope for her would be that she would be able to be in another district that would also benefit from her leadership." Wright promised to better work culture transformation when she was hired. Wright was hired on the heels of 2 locals, Laura Mitchell, a Cincinnati native who spent 27 years serving the district, and Tiane Amat, who worked in the area for nearly 2 decades before taking on the interim role. Amat also applied for the full-time superintendent job and was a finalist alongside Wright. Back then, Cincinnati was looking for something new. The board picked Wright because she was, quote, "committed to transformative, positive change," then board president Ben Lindy said. The district had pockets of success already. Walnut Hills High School is consistently ranked in the state's top schools, and Cincinnati's Montessori program is nationally recognized. But while Cincinnati students tested slightly higher than other urban school districts in the state, the board knew they could do better for kids, and Wright was known to transform failing schools into great ones, as she'd done in Florida and Detroit. In her first 100 days in Cincinnati, Wright hosted listening sessions with the community, spoke individually with school board members, visited classrooms, assessed school systems, pored over equity data, and developed a professional development plan for district employees. She determined early on that the district had, quote, "a fragmented culture." Staff felt like the district was divided between those in its central office and those in school buildings, she said. Wright was motivated to bridge that gap in order to improve supports for kids. Quote, "I appreciate the work that's being done by our staff," Wright said then. Quote, "All of them. Our teachers, our custodians, our paraprofessionals, our school office assistants. Everybody, it takes everyone. It takes all of us to make sure that our children are successful," end quote. She took to launching public initiatives, including the superintendent's ABCs, to focus on academics, behavior, and culture. She also launched the, quote, "Be Present" movement that encouraged everyone, teachers, parents, kids, neighbors, to do their part in making sure kids got to school on time to thrive. Wright took the Be Present initiative to heart, routinely visiting schools and posting dozens of selfies with students to her social media. But while some saw these efforts as genuine and positive, others scrutinized Wright's every move, and they let her know. A year into her tenure, union members sent letters to the board outlining several concerns with Wright's leadership. They said she was controlling, she bullied and embarrassed staff members, she didn't take seriously the input of veteran educators in the district, and she had fostered a culture of fear. At the time, Wright said these gripes were coming from a loud few. She held fast to her commitment to excellence, took a satisfactory evaluation from the school board as a nod to her early success, and proudly reported small improvements in the district's test scores after her first year. But Julie Sellers, president of the teachers' union and initially a proud advocate for Wright, didn't buy it. "Everyone's test scores went up after COVID-19," Sellers said. Once starry-eyed at Wright's tales of success elsewhere, Sellers said she had come to see that Wright wasn't a good fit for Cincinnati after all. Other union leaders said they'd understood that from the beginning. The title of the next section is Unions Reach a Breaking Point. If you ask Wright, her relationship with the district's unions crumbled in a matter of days. She told the Inquirer she, quote, didn't know that it was this bad, until the union votes were announced in early May. But some union leaders say Wright got off on the wrong foot 2 years ago when she doubled back on assertions she made during her interview process, and she never recovered. Quote, "She said everything we wanted to hear," Fanny Carradine, an administrative secretary in the district central office and president of the Cincinnati Federation of Office Professionals, said during a meeting with the Inquirer's editorial board. Carradine said Wright had told union leaders she had an open-door policy with unions. But once she was hired, Wright met only with the teachers' union and the administrators' union. Carradine was left to negotiate with one of Wright's chiefs, who had to get Wright's approval before making decisions. After a year of delays and frustration, Carradine said, Wright started to meet regularly with all of the district's unions. But union leaders agree that those meetings were unhelpful at best, and say that Wright didn't seem to understand the concept of collaboration at all. Quote, "It was apparent to us that her definition of collaboration was, I'm telling you, I'm informing you of this," end quote. Mike Turner, president of the administrative union, said, quote, "But that's not collaboration." The unions pointed to a recent budget snafu as a prime example of Wright's ineffective and troublesome leadership. Sellers said her union provided more than 24 suggestions to bring down the budget deficit earlier this school year, of which Wright only kept 3 in her presentation to the school board. That presentation didn't go over well. For months, Wright continually brought forth budget cut recommendations, including changes to transportation that went against the board's wishes, resulting in a stalemate that hindered schools from starting the hiring process for the upcoming school year. At a school board meeting in early May, Kareem Moffitt, a board member, said the board had, quote, "sat through 4 months now of having the same things brought back to us repeatedly, which is a huge waste of time and almost disrespectful. Clearly there is no collaboration," end quote, Moffitt said. A week before Wright submitted her resignation, the board considered a resolution that would have stripped Wright's authority to recommend personnel cuts and instead given the school board the power to identify which employees not to renew. Later, Bolton told the Inquirer that resolution was intended to, quote, "make an impression," end quote, that the board wasn't happy with Wright's process. The budget remains unbalanced as Wright departs from the district. This is the next section. Meanwhile, Sellers said a call for a no-confidence vote came from the ground up. Teachers were fed up with the budget extensions that started to point more and more to staff reductions. In a historic vote at the union's largest meeting on record, Sellers said, not a single member voted in favor of Wright. Though none of the unions would say how many members voted, all 6 said they had impressive turnouts and all overwhelmingly voted no confidence in Wright. Afterward, both Turner and Wright told the Enquirer separately that they did not see a way to salvage the union's broken relationship with the district superintendent. The school board will approve Wright's settlement agreement and appoint an interim leader Monday, Bolton said. But it's not clear when the search for a permanent replacement will begin. Last time, that search process took a full school year, and it was expensive. The district hired a search firm that cost $75,000, not including advertising and travel expenses. Not everyone on the board supported Wright's resignation. Lindy, the board president when Wright was hired, vehemently opposes her departure. He thinks Wright is the most talented superintendent the district has seen and is scared for what the district's uncertain future holds now that she's leaving. Quote, "The slimmest possible majority is choosing to push out our superintendent, despite the progress we're seeing, with no plan for what happens next in the middle of a budget crisis," Lindy said. His predictions for Cincinnati Public Schools after Wright leaves are grim. "What happens next is going to be bad." Quote, "The churn we see, the difficulty we have in attracting future superintendent candidates, the regression that we may see in results for students, all of this is the responsibility of this board president and the three other board members who support the superintendent's departure," end quote. The board will determine Wright's settlement on Monday. But Wright wasn't there to hear Lindy's support. Her chair, the seat meant for the leader of Ohio's second largest school system, one that serves 35,000 children and employs 6,500 workers, remained empty. Now the school board will look inward again for an interim leader to point them to what's next. Our next article is Silverton considers Wawa store, that's W-A-W-A, by Aaron Crouch. A Wawa may be on its way to Silverton. On May 20th, the Silverton Planning Commission will consider a submission for a Wawa gas station and convenience store on Montgomery Road near Stewart Road. Silverton Village Council first heard the informal presentation to introduce the idea at an April 18th meeting, according to village meeting minutes. J.R. Anderson of Jeffrey R. Anderson Real Estate and representatives from Wawa's corporate office introduced the project. The application goes to the Planning Commission first, then the Village Council. There are two public hearings as part of the process, one in front of the Planning Commission and one in front of Council. One concern raised by Council was traffic disruption. Anderson told officials at the time that a traffic study has been done and the project should not cause any major traffic problems in the area, meeting minutes say. The cult favorite gas station has been picking up steam in the greater Cincinnati area, with 60 stores planned in Ohio and others already planned in northern Kentucky. The Planning Commission meets at 5 p.m. May 22nd at Silverton Town Hall, 6943 Montgomery Road. Our next article is local meat processor to pay $1.7 million fine for safety violations, written by Alexander Coolidge. Green Township's Zwanenberg Food Group USA has agreed to pay $1.7 million in fines and make safety improvements to its local plant to resolve multiple investigations by the Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The processed food supplier, which employs about 175 local workers, agreed to invest $1.9 million into the plant for additional safeguards after it received citations in September 2022 and April and December 2023, following the injuries of two temporary workers. Federal safety inspectors determined the company exposed workers to hazards by allowing machinery to operate without the required safety guards during production and not ensuring equipment remained powered off when it was being cleaned. The regulatory settlement is expected to be finalized during a June 13th meeting of the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. The company also agreed to make several safety improvements, including enhance machine guarding, ensure each employee use locks during third shift sanitation, develop and rewrite lockout procedures for all equipment, train employees on the new machine safety procedures, an analysis by an independent third-party auditor of all equipment. A third-party consultant must also audit all personal protective equipment, hazardous communication, and lockout programs. Meet with OSHA at least quarterly to discuss safety and health issues. Zwanenburg is a subsidiary of Holland's Zwanenburg Food Group, which has 12 production facilities in the U.S., Netherlands, and United Kingdom. The company's products include ham, chili, luncheon meat, soups, stew, corned beef hash, and pastas marketed under brand names Vietti, Southgate, Halal, and various private label brands. Zwanenburg Food Group has taken important steps to improve plant safety, this is a quote, but the work of training new and existing employees on machine safety procedures to prevent injuries never ends, said OSHA Area Director Ken Montgomery in Cincinnati. In some national news, our next article is House Speaker coming to Cincinnati for fundraiser with Boehner, Red's owner, and Red's owner, written by Scott Wortman. After surviving an ouster attempt, U.S. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson will come to Cincinnati to raise money to increase the slim majority Republicans hold in the House. Johnson will hold a fundraiser May 30th at an undisclosed location with former Speaker of the House and Westchester resident John Boehner, as well as Red's owner, Bob Castellini, Punchbowl News has reported. The fundraiser will cost $1,500 to $25,000 to attend and will benefit Johnson's Grow the Majority Political Action Committee. The location hasn't been released to the public. While here, Johnson will also try to win back the congressional seat representing Cincinnati and Warren County. The Hamilton County Republican Party this week announced Johnson will headline a May 30th fundraiser in Cincinnati for Republican Orlando Sanza, who is running against incumbent Democratic Representative Greg Landsman in Ohio's 1st Congressional District. There will be fundraisers in Warren County and Hamilton County, but Sanza's campaign wouldn't release the locations of the fundraisers. A, quote, grassroots event will cost $100 a person, according to the announcement from the GOP. A private reception will cost $1,000 to $2,500. Quote, I think it's getting on people's radar, said Hamilton County GOP Chair Russ Mock about the 1st Congressional District race. Orlando is out there working really hard, end quote. Greater Cincinnati is not entirely friendly Republican turf for Johnson. Republicans hold a narrow 4-person majority in the House. Johnson just survived an attempt led by Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene and Northern Kentucky Representative Thomas Massey to remove him from the speakership. A second Cincinnati area congressman, Representative Warren Davidson, who represents western Hamilton County and Butler County, voted with Massey, Green, and 8 other Republicans for a measure that could have led to Johnson's removal. Landsman in 2022 flipped the 1st Congressional District seat for the Democrats, beating veteran Republican Representative Steve Chabot. Chabot had held the seat for 26 of the previous 28 years. Redistricting reforms passed by voters in 2018 required the General Assembly to redraw the district boundaries to include all of the Democrat-laden Cincinnati and eastern Hamilton County. Biden won the district by 8.5 percentage points in 2020, according to the Daily Kos. Sanza, 33, of Springfield Township, is an assistant prosecutor in Hamilton County. Landsman, 47, of Mount Washington, is in his first term as congressman. He previously served as a Cincinnati city councilman. Our next article, the headline is Man Who Blamed Fatal Stabbing on... Man who blamed fatal stabbing on, quote, a witch committed. And this is written by Kevin Grasha. A man who told police that he fatally stabbed a co-worker because, quote, a witch told him, end quote, that the co-worker intended to shoot him, was committed Thursday to a psychiatric hospital. Jan Tolentino will be under court supervision for the rest of his life. Earlier this month, Hamilton County Common Pleas Judge Megan Shanahan found Tolentino, who was charged with murder and felonious assault, not guilty by reason of insanity. On Thursday, Shanahan said that based on reports by mental health experts, Tolentino is mentally ill. Under state law, Shanahan said, because Tolentino faced a maximum of life in prison, the court will maintain jurisdiction over him for the maximum term he would have faced had he been convicted of the murder charge. He will be held at Summit Behavioral Health Care in Roselawn once a bed becomes available. He is now being held at the Hamilton County Justice Center. Tolentino was 18 when he stabbed 32-year-old Paris Dismukes at BJ's Restaurant and Brewhouse at the former Tri-County Mall. The stabbing happened the night of August 11, 2022. Dismukes had only been working at the restaurant for a few days, his father, Barry Cobb, told the Enquirer. Cobb said his son was working as a dishwasher and was carrying a pile of dishes when Tolentino stabbed him at least 25 times. Dismukes bled to death on the floor, Cobb said. When a Springfield police officer arrived at the restaurant, Tolentino, his brother, and their mother were at the entrance, according to court documents. The officer was told that Tolentino, quote, needs help. Tolentino told the officer, according to the documents, that, quote, a witch had told him that Dismukes was going to shoot him in the head, so that was why he stabbed him. Cobb said he believes Tolentino, now 20, was on drugs, possibly methamphetamine at the time, and that the killing was premeditated. Our next article is charges refiled in shooting of Indiana wife during 2022 blizzard by Cameron Knight. Charges were refiled this week against Gregory Guilfoyle, the Brookville, Indiana man accused of shooting his wife in the head, running off with her daughter, and then shooting a sheriff's deputy. Guilfoyle's wife, Hannah Lynch, was left for dead during a blizzard just a few days before Christmas in 2022. She survived, but has yet to see Guilfoyle go to trial. The case against Guilfoyle has been unusual. First, after his arrest, he was released to go live with his parents because he, too, had been shot that night. Investigators said he shot a Franklin County Sheriff's deputy while he was holding his own daughter in the other hand, but that deputy returned fire and struck Guilfoyle. The deputy was struck in his body armor and survived. Guilfoyle was left a paraplegic, according to his lawyer, Judson McMillan. The Franklin County Sheriff said the jail could not care for him, and he was released to await trial at his parents' home. Next, his parents sought custody of their granddaughter, the child of Lynch and Guilfoyle. The court sided against them, but the process took about 10 months. The next section is titled Charges Dropped. In February, about 14 months after the shootings, Guilfoyle was set to go to trial. However, both McMillan and Franklin County Prosecutor Chris Herkamp asked Circuit Court Judge Stephen Cox for more time to prepare for the trial. Cox denied the motions for a continuance. Without the trial looming, Herkamp decided to drop the charges. Unfortunately, I was compelled to make the decision to dismiss the charges for now in order to preserve the opportunity to put the state's best case forward at trial, because I don't get a second chance, Herkamp said. Next section is titled Charges Refiled, New Judge Requested. On Tuesday, Herkamp refiled the charges, two counts of attempted murder, two counts of neglect of a dependent, aggravated battery, domestic battery, and five other weapons charges. Herkamp also requested that Judge Cox recuse himself from the case and that a special judge be appointed. Herkamp wrote in his motion that Judge Cox personally visited Guilfoyle at his parents' house after the charges were filed to personally observe Guilfoyle's medical and mental condition. The prosecutor said Cox had also had discussions with psychological evaluators outside the courtroom and without the prosecution or defense present. Herkamp said Guilfoyle only appeared in court once via Zoom during the year of proceedings. He said Indiana law requires judges to disqualify themselves if their impartiality might be reasonably questioned, an example of which would be personal knowledge of the facts that are in dispute in the case. Herkamp argues that Guilfoyle's mental health and sanity are critical issues in the case. Guilfoyle's lawyer said he plans to show the jury his client is not guilty, in part by reason of insanity. Franklin County has two elected circuit court judges, and the cases are divided among them by the level of charge. So the refiled charges would default back to Judge Cox without this request for a new judge. Herkamp has asked for an initial hearing in the case to be held on May 22nd, but no official court dates have been rescheduled. Our next article is Police Identify 18-Year-Old Killed in Hyde Park Shooting, Bibi Hodges. Police have identified the 18-year-old who died following a shooting in Hyde Park early Saturday morning. At roughly 3:30 a.m., officers responded to the 2300 block of Dana Avenue near Withrow High School for a report of a person shot, according to a news release from Cincinnati Police. Upon arrival, respondents located Layman Wiggins, suffering from gunshot wounds. He was then transported to the University of Cincinnati Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead, police said. Before the shooting, police said that there was a gathering of around 50 people from Friday night into the early hours of Saturday morning. Police have not said if they have a suspect. Cincinnati police are still investigating. They are asking anyone with information to call the Homicide Unit or Crime Stoppers at 513-352-3040. Our next article is outgoing CPS superintendent will likely be paid through 2025 by Madeline Mitchell. Outgoing Cincinnati Public Schools Superintendent Irenetta Wright will likely be paid through the end of her contract, which comes up in July 2025, upon her resignation effective Monday. The Enquirer obtained the proposed settlement agreement between Wright and the district through an Ohio Public Records Act request. Wright signed the document Wednesday. The school board is set to approve it on Monday. If the settlement is approved, the district will pay Wright upwards of $260,000 in addition to payouts for unused vacation days, and will continue to offer Wright health insurance as well as dental and vision coverage until July 2025. Wright agreed to resign after all six of the district's unions made votes of no confidence in her leadership. School Board President Eve Bolton announced Wright's resignation Wednesday. While we understand that shifts of this magnitude can be unsettling, please know that the board remains dedicated to pursuing excellence in education and providing unwavering support to our students, staff, and stakeholders, Bolton read from a statement, including in the settlement agreement at Wednesday's meeting. Quote, "We are united in our efforts to be an inclusive and collaborative school district and be a place where each and every student is valued, supported, empowered, and prepared to pursue their fullest potential," end quote. The school board will meet Monday at 5:30 p.m. at the Mary A. Ronan Education Center, located at 2651 Burnett Avenue. Our next article comes from Aaron Glynn at the Columbus Dispatch, and the headline is DeWine Signs Bill Limiting Cell Phone Use in Ohio Classrooms. Ohio schools are now required to adopt a policy restricting cell phone use in classrooms. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signed legislation Wednesday requiring public K-12 school districts to create a policy to reduce cell phone distractions and limit cell phone use as much as possible during school hours. Schools that don't want to create their own policy can use a model from the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce, which DeWine said will be ready within 10 days. Quote, "Cell phones in classrooms pose a significant challenge to learning. It undermines instruction and exposes our kids to potential harmful content, DeWine said at the bill signing at Carer Middle School in the Columbus suburb of Dublin. Students will still be allowed to use their phones if they need to for a learning plan or to monitor a health condition. Lieutenant Governor John Husted says he wants students more focused on lessons than likes. He said the law will help students avoid social media during the school day. Quote, but we're not going to give up on the rest of the day either. We will continue to pursue a policy that puts parents back in charge in the digital lives of their children, he said. Both Husted and DeWine noted that the bill passed both legislative houses unanimously, which is rare. The law takes effect July 1st, 2025. Our next article is headlined, Toxins Reach Great Lakes, Study Says. The subtitle is Rain, Air, Pollute Water with Forever Chemicals, written by Caitlin Luby from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Dateline, Milwaukee. A considerable amount of, quote, forever chemicals are making their way into the Great Lakes via the air and rain, a new study says. In fact, the findings published in Environmental Science and Technology show that it's the primary way PFAS end up in Lake Superior, offering a stark reminder that even the lake that's considered the most pristine isn't safe from the toxic chemicals. PFAS, or per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are a class of thousands of compounds that are widespread and long-lasting in the environment. They contaminate drinking water and build up in fish and wildlife, posing many risks to humans, including certain kinds of cancers, reproductive harm, and liver and thyroid problems. The Great Lakes are the freshwater heart of North America. The basin is home to 10% of the U.S. population and 30% of the Canadian population, and the lakes provide drinking water for more than 40 million people. Reducing the amount of PFAS that go into the Great Lakes is a challenge that will require looking at every source that brings them there, said Marta Venier, an environmental chemist at Indiana University who led the research. PFAS come in different sizes, is the title of the next section. PFAS are used in a lot of different products, like firefighting foam, nonstick cookware, food wrappers, laundry detergents, personal care products, and outdoor gear. They are popular because they make products waterproof as well as stain and grease resistant. The chemicals are grouped into two different size classes, short and long chain. Short chain PFAS are much smaller, and because of that can easily travel long distances hitchhiking on rain and air particles. Many long-chain PFAS were phased out and replaced with short-chain ones because it was believed that there were fewer health risks, Venier said. The risks were greatly underestimated, she said. The title to the next section is Lake Ontario's Water Had the Most PFAS. The scientists collected air and rain samples at five sites around the basin. Two urban locations, Chicago and Cleveland, one rural site at Sturgeon Point, New York, and two remote sites, Eagle Harbor, Michigan, and Sleeping Bear Dunes, Michigan. The team also collected lake water samples throughout each of the five lakes. Combined with existing information on other sources of PFAS, like tributaries that drain into lakes and wastewater treatment plants, the researchers were able to figure out what lake has the highest concentration of PFAS in its water and where most of the chemicals come from. Lake Ontario had the highest concentration of PFAS in its water, followed by lakes Michigan, Erie, and Huron. According to the study, the easternmost lake likely had the highest levels because it is the most urbanized and is the lake that all others drain into. Lake Superior had the lowest concentration of the toxic chemicals. Most of the PFAS found in lakes were the short-chain, more mobile kind. The title of the next section is PFAS levels in rain. The study showed that when it comes to rain, it didn't matter whether it was Chicago or Sleeping Bear Dunes. PFAS levels were the same across all the lakes. "This is the first time we've seen that," Vanier said. "Usually pollutant levels are higher near urban centers, like with PCBs or pesticides. On the other hand, PFAS levels in the air samples were higher near urban sites and lower in the remote locations." Overall, atmosphere delivery through rain and air is a significant pathway for PFAS making their way into the upper Great Lakes, especially Lake Superior. According to the study, almost all the PFAS that wind up in Lake Superior come from the atmosphere, compared to wastewater treatment plants and tributaries that drain into the largest Great Lake. In Lake Michigan, roughly half comes from the air and rain. The scientists also looked at the balance of PFAS going into the lakes versus being discharged out. According to the study, Lakes Superior, Michigan, and Huron are accumulating PFAS faster than they are getting rid of them. The title to the next section is Lack of Information. Earlier this year, the federal government set the first national drinking water limit on certain kinds of PFAS. While the study didn't directly test drinking water, Vanier said that reducing PFAS in both the environment and drinking water will mean controlling all sources and taking a broad, multi-pronged approach. But of the biggest challenges that remain is the lack of data on where the PFAS are coming from. Vanier was surprised at how little information there was on the concentration of PFAS in tributaries as well as downstream of wastewater treatment plants. Quote, "These are data gaps that we need to fill before we can have a solid picture of all the ins and outs of PFAS in the Great Lakes," she said. Our next article has the headline, "Five American Doctors Allowed to Leave Gaza, Others Remain," by Hanan Adeli. Five Americans who had been trapped in Gaza after Israel sealed borders, preventing their crossing, departed the besieged conflict zone early Friday. They were part of a medical team that went to the war zone to provide emergency medical care. Gada Abukuwaik from Totowa, New Jersey, said they left about 6 a.m. local time, reaching the U.S. Embassy about 4 hours later. Other American doctors on the team were expected to follow, but it was not clear when they would be able to leave. The 19-member team entered Gaza on May 1st and have been stuck there since Israel seized and closed the border crossing into Egypt, cutting off access to humanitarian aid and medical crews. The team has 10 Americans, including Dr. Adam Hamawi of Princeton, New Jersey, who saved the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat from Illinois, in 2004 in Iraq, where he served as a combat trauma surgeon in the U.S. Army. Abukuwaik, CEO of CureMed Pharmacy, said the whole team should be allowed to leave, not just the Americans. "The way we left," this is a quote, "the way we left is not the way we should leave," she said. "We came as a team." She and others are also deeply worried, Abukuwaik said, because Israel has said it will not permit a team of replacement aid workers to enter Gaza. The team has been waiting in Cairo. Quote, "What about the other people?" Abukuwaik said. "We're just going to leave them this way? All the supplies and medication we brought with us, it's almost done. So what are they going to do?" End quote. The team is staying in Israel until it can coordinate travel to the United States, the State Department told the office of U.S. Representative Bill Pascrell, Democrat from New Jersey, on Friday. Pascrell, among other state and federal officials, had pressured Israeli leaders to allow the team to depart. The medical workers said they were shocked by the destruction, frequent bombings, and lack of basic medical supplies, including anesthesia, wound care, and blood. The team traveled to Gaza with the Palestinian American Medical Association under the umbrella of the World Health Organization. Another medical team from the Texas-based nonprofit FAJR Scientific also was trapped when borders were sealed. Dr. Mossab Nasser, CEO of FAJR Scientific, said his team also evacuated Friday. quote, "The reality is very different from the shots you see on TV. It's a million times worse," Nasser said in an interview with British TV host Piers Morgan, describing that it looked like a place where a hurricane, earthquake, and tsunami had all hit. Quote, "While looking at the destroyed buildings, I kept asking myself, how can you create such destruction in such a record time?" His team of 12 Americans, 3 Britons, 1 Egyptian, and 1 Omani had to flee their safe houses twice due to the bombings. "The level of terror at night was unbearable," he said. In an interview Thursday, Abu Kawaik recalled, quote, "heartbreaking cases, including a 10-year-old boy brought to the hospital whose family had been killed and who suffered burns on 70% of his body. He died 3 days later. Another time, an orphaned 8-year-old boy had come looking for insulin for his 5-year-old brother, but they had none. Quote, "You don't have the resources," she said. "You don't have medical equipment. You don't have the right medication. Many medications are out of stock." End quote. One of the biggest needs, she said, is staff. Local staffing has been depleted, especially in recent days, as many are evacuating with their families out of Rafah. In a video posted on the Palestinian American Medical Association's social media pages, Hamawi described seeing a, quote, "constant stream of injured civilians and feeling the hospital shake from repeated bombings." Our next article is Nippon Steel Executive to Meet U.S. Stakeholders. This is by Urvi Dugar, Akansha Kushi, and Yuka Abayashi from Reuters. Dateline Tokyo. Japan's Nippon Steel said Saturday its vice chairman Takahiro Mori, a key negotiator for its planned purchase of U.S. steel, will travel to the United States this week to meet stakeholders as part of continued efforts to complete the deal. A spokesperson for Nippon Steel in Tokyo said Mori will visit the United States to continue dialogues with various stakeholders for the deal to gain a better understanding. She declined to give further details, such as who Mori will be meeting with and how long he will stay in the U.S. U.S. Steel deferred to the Japanese company for comment. In December, Nippon Steel offered nearly $15 billion to take over U.S. Steel, drawing resistance for both Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican former President Donald Trump, as well as the United Steelworkers Union. To win support from the union, Nippon Steel has pledged to move its U.S. headquarters to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where U.S. Steel is based, offering commitments on job security and additional investments if the deal goes through. Bloomberg reported on Friday that Mori will travel to Pittsburgh this week to meet with local staff and elected officials, citing people briefed on the matter. The Japanese steelmaker expects to close the deal in the second half of 2024, compared with its prior deadline of the second to third quarter, after the Department of Justice sought more details and materials in an antitrust review. The European Commission already approved the deal. Despite mounting opposition, an overwhelming majority of U.S. Steel shareholders voted in favor of the deal in April. Our next article is STRS Ohio board members want to know who was behind hostile takeover memo by Laura A. Bischoff. Some members of the state teachers' retirement system of Ohio really want to know which pension fund employees wrote an anonymous 14-page memo and then dropped it off to the governor. Board member Julie Sellers on Thursday floated the idea of hiring an investigator to find the leak. The board agreed to hold off on that until it can consult with an outside attorney before a special May 30th meeting. The anonymous memo alleged that STRS is facing a, quote, hostile takeover by private interests and that 2 board members, Wade Steen and Rudy Fichtenbaum, have connections to those interests. Governor Mike DeWine shared the memo and other documents with Attorney General Dave Yost, who then filed a civil lawsuit against Steen and Fichtenbaum, to try to remove them from the pension board. Rather than seeing the Yost lawsuit as a red flag, the board voted 6-5 on Wednesday to make Fichtenbaum the chairman. The question was asked who would pay for lawyers to defend Steen and Fichtenbaum. The assistant attorney general assigned to the STRS board said it's up to the attorney general to decide if they're eligible for state-funded lawyers. The teachers' pension fund has faced turbulent times in recent years. A consultant hired to help the board with governance issues quit. An anonymous emailer flooded STRS with more than 500 public records requests. Steen waged a year-long battle to regain his seat after the governor removed him and returned to the board in April. Now he says he and his family are receiving anonymous threats. The board put STRS Executive Director Bill Neville on paid leave in November based on an anonymous letter accusing him of harassment. And an investigation concluded in February that the allegations are meritless. The board voted Thursday to continue Neville's paid leave until June 30th. Quote, "There is nothing that should keep him from coming back to work. The allegations were clearly unfounded. He did a fantastic job for the teachers and helped save the pension funds," said Rex Elliott, Neville's attorney. What is STRS? STRS Ohio, created in 1920, oversees $90 billion invested on behalf of 500,000 teachers and retirees. It's controlled by an 11-member board that includes teachers and retirees elected by members and three investment experts appointed by state leaders. The system gets its money through investment returns and employer and employee contributions. Teachers contribute 14% of their paychecks, and school districts chip in another 14% to the pension. STRS is lobbying lawmakers to increase the employer contribution rate. It's a defined benefit system, which means retirees are guaranteed a monthly pension check based on their final average salaries and years of service. STRS is one of five public pension systems in Ohio. Combined, the five systems have about $225 billion invested for 655,000 public employees, 486,000 retirees, and 1.1 million former government workers. Public employees in Ohio aren't in the Social Security system, so the pension funds are their primary retirement money. The next section is titled STRS, A Brief Recap. Pension reforms adopted by the state lawmakers in 2012 forced public employees and retirees to shoulder more of the burden to shore up the retirement systems. The reform law allowed the STRS board to set the annual cost of living allowance given to retired teachers. The standard 3% cost of living COLA was cut and then eliminated for 5 years to help stabilize the system's finances. Retirees got a 3% adjustment in 2023 and 1% in 2024, but not nearly what they want. The Ohio Retirement for Teachers Association and STRS watchdogs began pressing the board to restore the COLA. STRS has about 500 employees and manages about 70% of the $90 billion portfolio in-house. The 60 investment staffers can earn generous bonuses if STRS's portfolio earns more than its benchmarks. Bonuses are paid out even if STRS loses money in that year. The STRS investment employees getting bonuses while retirees go without inflationary increases is a major point of contention. The STRS board is expected to vote in June on changes to the bonus program. Another issue is STRS's alternative investments, such as private equity and real estate. The value and cost of those holdings is more opaque than other investments, such as stocks and bonds. The title of the next section is Why is Dave Yost Suing? Fichtenbaum and Steen and two former board members advocated that STRS consider an alternative investment strategy pitched by Seth Metcalf and J.D. Tremmel, who formed multiple businesses with the letters QED in them. Metcalf served in the state treasurer's office under Republican Josh Mandel. STRS investment staff, Neville, and an outside consultant rejected QED because it lacked a track record and its strategy isn't used by other institutional investors. In June 2021, Fichtenbaum said in a posted column to Facebook that he and Steen have a way for STRS to reduce its expenses, increase transparency, and earn an additional $4 billion in returns. In November 2021, Fichtenbaum made a presentation to the STRS board that advocated partnering with QED. He suggested that to earn an additional $4 billion in returns, STRS would have to commit $65 billion to the strategy, according to a transcript of the meeting. The board declined. Yost's lawsuit alleges that Steen and Fichtenbaum have backdoor ties to QED's Metcalf and Tremel, and that they're trying to steer $65 billion to QED. Steen said that the lawsuit is loaded with defamatory statements, and he promised to fight it. You know what? We're going to go back to some of our small articles to conclude things here today. Today in history. Today is May 20th. On this date in 1609, William Shakespeare's sonnets were first published in London. 1902, the Republic of Cuba declared its independence from the United States. The island had been a protectorate of the U.S. since the end of the Spanish-American War in 1898. 1916, the Saturday Evening Post published its first Norman Rockwell cover illustration. 1927, aboard the Spirit of St. Louis, Charles Lindbergh took off from Long Island, New York, to begin his transatlantic flight to Paris. He landed the next day, becoming the first pilot to make the solo, non-stop flight across the Atlantic Ocean. 1932, Amelia Earhart took off from Newfoundland, Canada, to begin her flight to Northern Ireland. When she landed the next day, she became the first female pilot to make a solo, non-stop transatlantic flight. 1956, the U.S. tested its first hydrogen bomb from an aircraft over Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. And in 1961, Freedom Riders arriving in Montgomery, Alabama, were attacked by a white mob and beaten, some of them hospitalized. The violence spurred U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy to send in hundreds of U.S. Marshals to keep the peace. This was compiled by William Kane of the USA Today Network. That concludes the first hour of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Monday, May 20th, 2024. My name is Ed Goldman. Thank you.